Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Over the weekend, I fell down one of those YouTube rabbit holes, you know, when you kind of click from video to video. Well, what I was doing is I was watching a lot of videos about Volkswagen's new all-electric bus. And to me, the launch videos were kind of hilarious. I mean, taking a 1960s automotive icon and souping it up for the 21st century requires things like modern celebrity endorsements and cross promotions. So VW has a video of actor Ewan McGregor doing his best Obi-Wan, "These are not the buses your father drove," product endorsement stare.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been a Volkswagen enthusiast pretty much all my life, I think it's true to say.
Sorry, guys, I couldn't help it. So apologies to the late Alec Guinness. But I'd argue that the new VW bus, called the ID Buzz, is actually more droid than van, because it's basically a computer and battery on wheels, albeit with a nostalgic two-tone paint job. And Volkswagen is hitting that nostalgia button hard.
And this for a good reason. In the 60s, the Volkswagen microbus stood for a new feeling of independency and great love. We still long for that today. ID Buzz takes up this attitude of life and transfers it into our time.
Okay, no more VW videos, because we don't want to sound like we're coming off as a product endorsement program here, because we don't do that. And by the way, the ID Buzz isn't going to be available in the United States until next year anyway. But the point is, you heard that word, right? He said independency. And that feeling that he was trying to evoke. So, I mean, give VW credit. It knows its U.S. audience, because when you're talking to Americans about cars, you're talking about a national culture and history built around an emotional story, the story of independence, of freedom, of the all-American road trip. However, there is one thing that story does not include in our all-electric future. One thing that until recently has thought to bedevil electric vehicles. That is range anxiety. I mean, you can't take a road trip, can you, while being stressed out about your battery? Now, we're going to talk later about whether EV owners actually truly suffer from range anxiety. But earlier this year, President Joe Biden announced a major plan to speed what he called America's electric vehicle future.
$7.5 billion. $7.5 billion to build a national network of 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations across America.
It's called the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, or NEVI. And over the past week, all 50 states have submitted their proposals for how they would invest their share of that money. Now, we ask you how you'd spend that $7.5 billion. Tom Ganser in Whitewater, Wisconsin, thinks a national EV charging network should mirror America's last great nationwide transportation project.
I think the most important thing to do, and in some ways the simplest thing to do, is to take advantage of the logic that was behind the creation of the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System in the mid-1950s and make efforts to install EV charging stations, first and foremost, along the interstate highway system in the United States. We would need and want charging stations elsewhere, but starting with charging stations on the interstate highway system, I think, would be a perfect way to start.
That's On Point listener Tom Ganser in Whitewater, Wisconsin. And by the way, his idea actually does have strong echoes in what the Biden administration hopes to do. But is that really the best way to prepare for the nation's growing electric vehicle fleet? So today we're going to look for ideas on how to spend that $7.5 billion most effectively to serve American drivers today and tomorrow. And joining us now is Samantha Houston. She is Senior Vehicles Analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Transportation Program. Samantha, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna. Pleased to be here with you.
And also with us is Alexander Laska, Senior Policy Advisor for Transportation at the think tank Third Way. Alexander, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
And by the way, I should note that both of them join us today from Washington, D.C. Now, first of all, let me let's lay out some of the specifics about the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. Samantha, how would you describe what the overall vision that the Biden administration has is?
Sure, Meghna. The overall vision is really focused on corridor charging. So these longer distance trips that you've mentioned. And this investment is really set up to pave the way, if you will, for a national network of EV charging so that consumer drivers can have the confidence to go on the road trips that they'd like to go on and feel confident about being able to get a charge along the way.
Yeah. So the goal is, according to the Transportation Department, right, 500,000 EV chargers nationwide by 2030. Alexander, are there already sort of limitations on where those federally funded EV chargers would go?
Yeah, you know, as I think about the NEVI program, two things really stick out in my mind that speak to that. The first is that I think it's important to recognize that every state is getting money from this program. This isn't a competitive program where you apply and you make your case and hopefully you get the money, maybe you don't. This is a formula program. So every state, whether you're a densely populated state on the coasts or a rural state inland, you're going to be getting money for EV charging. And this really speaks to Congress's commitment and the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to make sure that no matter where you live, no matter where you work, no matter where you may go, you are going to be able to find a place to charge your vehicle. And, you know, so when we're thinking about the NEVI program, the other important thing I would mention here is that there is a real focus in this program, not exclusively, but definitely predominantly on Level 3, otherwise known as direct current or DC fast chargers. So these are the fastest chargers that are out there. And what this really means is that whether you're a commuter or going on that all-American road trip or just out and about on your day and you happen to be driving past a kiss and ride near the highway, you're going to be able to pull up to one of these stations and charge your vehicle quickly. I mean, a DC fast charger can give you, in 1 hour, you're basically filling up. You're getting, 80 miles plus range in just 15 minutes. So, not as fast as refueling at a gas station, but this is a big deal in terms of making sure that we have, as Sam just spoke to, a fast, convenient, reliable network of EV charging along our highways.
Well, you're laying out quite a glittering future of possibility here, Alexander, and I appreciate that. And I'm going to lay all my cards out here on the table right up front. I am fully in support of, trying to do what we can as a nation to transition to an electric vehicle fleet. And we'll talk about sort of the complications around that because listeners did raise some questions and we'll get to those later. But that's why I want to actually really engage with this hour in terms of, so what are the best ideas to get us there? But before we do that, I mean, Samantha, let's just talk about the specifics that the Biden administration has laid out because the devil is always in the details. So for example, I'm seeing that the proposals coming from the states, if I understand this correctly, the EV charging stations that they would proposed to build within their state borders have to go along something called alternative fuel corridors. Now, for people who aren't familiar with that, what are those?
Sure. Alternative fuel corridors are highways that the government has designated as roads or highways, rather, corridors where they will prioritize installing alternative fueling infrastructure. Now, electric fueling or charging infrastructure is the piece that we're focused on, but it is a bit broader than that.
Okay. So they are putting then limitations on where these federally funded charging stations could go.
There are limitations insofar as states need to focus on those alt fuel or alternative fuel corridors first. And really, the point there is you've got to start somewhere. And mm-hmm. these roads are the key arteries that connect our nation. So the Joint Office of Energy and Transportation has laid out guidance about focusing on those first before states focus on other roads. But certainly in many of the state plans, we see states considering a broader view. They are saying how they're going to spend their national EV infrastructure or NEVI funds, but they're also thinking about that in the context of other investments and other plans the state has to build out sort of the broader ecosystem of charging.
Right, right. And so then, the NEVI program, does it stipulate, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because transportation policy can be quite a detailed thing, but it stipulates what, that the charging stations would have to go every 50 miles, every 50 miles?
That is the current guidance, okay. Yes. And there is a process for states to request exemptions to that. So we'll see as the Federal Highway Administration and the joint office that I mentioned evaluate the plans that the states did submit, whether some of the exemption requests that were part of those plan submissions are granted.
Okay. So here's a question. Roughly every 50 miles on existing American interstate highways, on the surface of it, it makes sense. Alexander, is that really the best way to spend the money? Because don't most Americans do the majority of their driving not on the highways, but within, 10, 15, 20 miles of where they live?
That's a good point. And, at Third Way, we really view this NEVI program and the sort of corridor charging that we're talking about as being one slice of the charging pie. And so, that is not the only place where we need chargers. We absolutely need charging stations throughout our communities, at public parking lots, in private parking lots when you're going to the grocery store or stopping at the movies, you can plug in and charge there. We also know from several years of data now that the vast majority of charging happens at home overnight. But it's important to keep in mind that the vast majority of EV drivers right now have a place they can charge at home. They have a garage or dedicated off-street parking.
Well, Alexander Laska and Samantha Houston, stand by here. We're talking about what it would take to build a truly national EV charging network. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about what it would take to build a truly nationwide electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Now, the Biden administration this year rolled out what it's calling the National EV Infrastructure Program, and that is $7.5 billion in federal money that would go to each of the 50 states to build charging stations along American highways, roughly every 50 miles, and along what the Biden administration calls alternative energy corridors. But we're asking today, is that the best way to spend a sizable chunk of change in order to help usher in the EV revolution in this country. And we're joined by Samantha Houston. She's senior vehicles analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Transportation Program. And Alexander Laska joins us as well. He's senior policy advisor for transportation at the center-left think tank Third Way. Now, Samantha and Alexander, just listen along with me because we wanted to talk to what I'm going to call essentially an EV native, someone who's grown up driving almost nothing but electric vehicles. And that is Alec Watson. His first car was an EV. It was a used Chevy Volt that he started driving to his first job back in 2015. He was his family's EV guinea pig, let's put it that way. And the experiment was a success because then his parents bought a Chevy Bolt. That's Bolt with a B. And this year, Alec upgraded his Volt to a Hyundai Ioniq 5, the Korean car maker's top-of-the-line EV. Now, in all that EV experience, Alex also became a successful YouTuber. His channel is called Technology Connections, and it covers all sorts of topics. But a recurring theme is his frustration with some of the misconceptions, he says, that people have about EVs and the way charging them actually works in practice.
I have never once thought about when is my car going to be finished charging. It's just not a thing that enters my mind because I plug it in when I get home, it's going to be full again the next day. So I have spent virtually no time day to day thinking of how I'm going to charge the vehicle. It's only ever been on road trips when I've needed to use the DC fast charging infrastructure. So that is by far, I think, the biggest thing people can't help themselves from fixating on is how long does it take to charge the car? And they don't understand that you can do other things while the car is charging, including sleep.
I would say if you have a charger on your property, and we'll talk about that in a second. But Alex says that in the 7 years he's owned an electric vehicle, the first time he charged it away from home, the very first time was this year when he took a road trip from Illinois to Florida. He charged it up at stations run by Electrify America, a nationwide network of fast chargers that's owned by Volkswagen.
I've driven to Florida a few times in my life, and it felt like it took the least amount of time because having to stop every 160 to 200 miles for 15 or 20 minutes was actually really good for preventing fatigue. And it is about the perfect time to take a break anyway. So we just would plug in the car, maybe head into a Walmart if it was next to there, and grab a couple drinks. And by the time we were, you know, having used the bathroom, got our drinks, got back to the car, we were about ready to unplug. So yeah, it was a wonderful experience.
Now, Electrify America, that network, is owned by Volkswagen, as I mentioned, but it charged Alex Hyundai just fine. That's because all EVs sold in the U.S., and ones, I should say, that are not made by Tesla, now use the same standard plugs. And Tesla itself has made hints that it's going to move to that industry-wide standard. By the way, it uses a standard already in Europe. But that 350-watt kilowatt fast charger Alec used on his road trip is, as he puts it, orders of magnitude more complicated than the charger that electric vehicle owners use at home.
350 kilowatts is an immense amount of power. A 200 amp service in the United States, you might be familiar with, your home has 100 amp or 200 amp service. If you have 200 amp service, that means the maximum amount of power that your house can pull from the grid is 48 kilowatts. So these 350 kilowatt chargers are pulling as much power as seven homes to the max. So the equipment that handles this power is obviously bulky. It needs a lot of cooling and fans. It's got massive power cables hooked up to it because it's literally, basically, you could think of it like a small apartment building is all getting shoved into your car.
Now, charging technology is, of course, improving all the time. We've just seen it in the past couple of years. But the fact is, it's always going to be a challenge to achieve faster charging speeds without catching that battery on fire. So while Alex says DC fast chargers are great for a road trip, he says they're only one part of getting electric vehicles to mass adoption.
What I would like to see besides that is much more robust level two infrastructure, which is incredibly cheap as far as the actual charging units themselves. It's basically running a dryer circuit, and you can get someone well along their way to charging an EV. But we need to figure out ways to make that happen for neighborhoods with on-street parking, for multi-residential situations, and also just lowering the cost for level two infrastructure. My very deeply held belief is that DC fast charging is great for long distance travel, but you shouldn't be forced into it because it is so much more convenient to charge your car at work or at home.
That's Alec Watson. His YouTube channel is Technology Connections. Okay, so Alexander, let's first get to what would it take, as Alec describes, to build these DC fast chargers, you know, in sometimes in quite rural places in the United States. Is it going to take a lot of construction, a lot of additional infrastructure, a lot of local grid work?
It's going to take all of that and more. You know, when we're talking about installing DC fast chargers, just as Alex said, I mean, these are highly electrified, highly specialized pieces of industrial equipment. What that means is that we need a lot of workers, electricians, contractors, and others trained up for that. So there are a lot of job opportunities here, both constructing and installing those stations, but also operating and maintaining them. But in addition to that, we absolutely need to make sure that with the rise of EVs, we have a grid that can handle the additional demand for electricity we're going to be seeing. And that takes physical infrastructure, new transmission and new distribution lines, which, again, more jobs for people. But it also means grid modernization. And there are a lot of states and utilities that have been experimenting with how to smooth demand for EV charging with innovations like smart charging, where you plug in your vehicle at home overnight and it charges when the grid tells it to, when the grid tells it that there's capacity to charge. So there are ways to smooth out demand to make sure that the grid we have today, as well as the grid we'll have tomorrow with these investments, can handle the additional demand for electricity.
Okay, so Samantha, let me ask you about that, because I have been wondering quite a bit about the additional load that ideally millions more electric vehicles might put on that grid that we have. I mean, the nation's electric grids have already proven to be fragile, to put it lightly. So wouldn't that $7.5 billion perhaps be better spent to first make our electric grid more resilient so it can meet both present and future demands?
Sure, that's a great question. And you and both, as Alexander also mentioned, we absolutely have to invest in the grid. I think one important thing to remember is that this National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program isn't happening in isolation. There are many other investments being made by electric utilities, being made by transmission grid operators. We certainly need those folks to pick up the pace. We cannot accept an unreliable grid full stop, not for EV charging or anything else. And so I think it's all of it. We need to do this concurrently if we're going to accelerate the pace of electrification and reductions of greenhouse gases, that global warming pollution from transportation, as soon as possible. We're going to get to a highly electrified future, and it's just a matter of how fast, and we really must get there as fast as we possibly can.
Mm. Well, so let me just put it straight to both of you. Do you think that, again, $7.5 billion is a lot, and it's a meaningful investment, but is putting it on those alternative vehicle corridors, aka certain identified highways, every 50 miles apart, is that the best way to spend this money? Because couldn't it be better spent? We talked about the grid. Maybe couldn't it be better spent to increase the infrastructure of fast charging stations in cities and suburbs and exurbs closer to where people are actually doing the majority of their driving, Samantha?
That's such an important question. And really, we need the full NEVI program to be behind corridor charging. We also need all those investments in community sites, in street-side charging, you know, all of these other areas that we've mentioned. But the fact of the matter is it's going to take at least that amount from NEVI to get close to minimum coverage for our corridors. And that's important because the road trip uncertainty that some folks have about taking an EV on a road trip, especially for some routes that don't already have coverage, that's what's holding people back. Some drivers who might be considering an EV, and so we really have to unlock that piece of the puzzle. Really get that part of the charging ecosystem up and going, so that that person who's on the bubble about adopting the EV but just doesn't know if, you know, the summer road trip that they take once a year is that they're going to be able to use the EV. We really have to open that door for them to really accelerate this transition to EVs.
Okay. So, but you know how I mentioned earlier about, does range anxiety actually exist? And I asked that question because even just in the course of this week, when people found out we were going to be doing this hour, I started getting emails from listeners saying they don't think range anxiety exists. It's just like, because most people, once they like get into an electric car and they think about how they're using it, you know, there's no problem. As you, Alexandra, as you pointed out, most people are just charging at home anyway. So are we putting too much emphasis on this concern about people being able to take road trips? Whereas if we're really going to speed EV adoption, we need to make it as easy as possible to charge cars where people are actually driving them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I would point out, though, that, you know, today's EV drivers are more likely to be high income, a lot more likely to have a garage or other dedicated parking where they can plug in overnight. But when we're talking about, and this is to a point that the YouTuber Alec made, you know, when we're talking about people in cities, for example, who live in multifamily housing units or otherwise don't have access to dedicated parking that has a way to charge, on-street parking, charging in parking lots, charging at the workplace are going to be really important, too. And to that point, let's make sure that we are viewing the NEVI program as, you know, a tool in the toolkit. And there is funding in the bipartisan infrastructure law for charging in communities. $2.5 billion of that $7.5 billion we've been talking about is a competitive grant program that states and cities are going to be able to apply to and make their case for where they think that money is best spent on building out charging or other types of alternative fueling infrastructure. And so we could certainly see build out of public charging, on-street charging that way. And then I would also really want to quickly mention that in part of this reconciliation bill that we're expecting to pass soon, Congress is expanding and extending the tax credit for alternative refueling property that includes EV charging. And so that's a way that we're going to be seeing, again, charging at workplaces and places of business, charging at multi-unit dwellings, apartment buildings, and the like. Mm. So the NEVI program, as I mentioned, is really one slice of the EV charging pie, and it is certainly important. But what we know is that people want, wherever they go, a fast, seamless, reliable, and safe charging experience.
Yeah. And if I could add to that, Meghna?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I think another two important things to think about. We've alluded to, you know, one slice of the pie. Certainly there may be other federal slices like we're seeing, you know, could come to pass in the reconciliation bill that is live right now in the form of the infrastructure tax credit. But there's also investments from states, from electric utilities in exactly the kind of charging that you are talking about in terms of within communities where people spend most of their time. And the second thing is the federal agencies, particularly the Federal Highway Administration and the Joint Office of Energy and Transportation, are uniquely positioned to help play a sort of high-level coordinating role. So I think that's one reason I think that having the administration focus on nationwide corridor charging very early on in their work on this issue and their investments in this makes a lot of sense. The states are submitting plans, so there is an element of, you know, the state level coordination, but the Federal Highway Administration will have visibility into all those plans, and that's a role that they can uniquely play in terms of making sure there is coordination across states and really can help drive some of the sort of minimum expectations, the safety, the coverage that Alexander was also mentioning.
Okay, so let's listen to what some listeners have to say. This is Don Cravens, Senior Vice President, actually, for Policy at the National Urban League. Actually, I don't know if Don's a listener. I hope he is. Here's how he put it to the National Electric Vehicle Summit back in January.
access to EVs and charging infrastructure is a civil rights issue, I can think of it for at least two reasons. One, environmentally. Secondly, economically. As we move forward and we build our clean energy future, it's important to remember that too often poor and disadvantaged, underserved communities are often the first ones who suffer the most environmental harms, but who also benefit the least from the economic gains, the economic environmental fixes.
So that's Don Cravens at the National Urban League with his view on how money could be spent. This is On Point listener Margie Bone, an EV owner in Seattle, Washington. And she, of course, lives in a city, but she thinks rural areas should be prioritized when it comes to charging infrastructure.
I think the most important thing is to increase the density of chargers in rural areas. For one thing, I think it's more important for people in rural areas to use electric vehicles because they have to drive more miles than those of us who live in the city. And as a city dweller with an electric car, there are, I mean, it could be better, but there are quite a few chargers, and I really don't worry about my range in the city. It's when I go into the more rural areas like in eastern Washington that the chargers are few and far between and I think need to be increased.
That's On Point listener Margie Bone in Seattle, Washington. And today we are talking about how to best spend that $7.5 billion that the Biden administration has committed towards building a national electric vehicle charging infrastructure. I'm joined today by Samantha Houston and Alexander Alaska, and we'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the Biden administration's plan to build 500,000 electric vehicle chargers across the United States, a national EV charging network, by 2030. I'm joined today by Samantha Houston. She's with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Alexander Laska is with us as well. He's with the think tank Third Way, and we're getting some response here from listeners. Mo Morris says, the stations will only serve people that own EVs. Why not spend that money on developing a more robust national mass transit system? John Lawrence Hansen says, if all we're doing with an EV vehicle push is to prop up the status quo of roads and single-person driving, then we'll lose. We need to direct this investment towards electric vehicles that run all day, like buses, cabs, delivery, etc. Now, as we talked about earlier in the show, the Biden administration is offering to spend $7.5 billion on this national network of electric vehicle chargers. And two-thirds of that money, about $5 billion, will be divided up between the states according to a predetermined formula. And more importantly, before the states get money to do anything else in their plans that the states are submitting, each state government has to first work with private companies to build up what are called those alternative fuel corridors that we talked about. Now, once that's done, the states can get the rest of the cash to spend on other things like slower but less expensive level two chargers that they can put not on highways, but say places like workplaces, shopping malls, and schools. But again, those fast chargers on the highways are really the focus of the bulk of the dollars here. Now, almost every state really does seem to be playing ball with this idea. They're submitting their plans. But we were wondering what was going on in Wyoming, because that state's plan goes against the federal specifications. Instead, Wyoming is demanding an exemption. And if it doesn't get one, state officials say they are willing to leave the EV money on the table. Interesting, right? Because Wyoming is a very sparsely populated state. And, you know, common wisdom might say Wyoming would be pretty keen to make it easy for EVs to cover long distances. But as Jordan Ox says, and Jordan's a public relations specialist with the Wyoming Department of Transportation, there are other factors at play.
We feel that while there is some range anxiety out there, people would rather be charging somewhere where they have infrastructure beyond the charging, like restaurants, hotels, shopping, especially when it's winter and if it's blizzarding, they don't want to be in the middle of nowhere at a station by itself.
It's about 50 miles from Cheyenne, Wyoming's capital, to Laramie, the closest major town. So far, so good.
But then Laramie to Rawlins is about, you're testing my math here, like about 100. So we'd have to put a station in the middle of that stretch, which is in a very small town named Elk Mountain, which traps people in the winter sometimes because it's a very wintry place in the winter. And you know, there's a gas station there, and that's about it.
Jordan gives us another example. The towns of Buffalo and Gillette, Wyoming, are 70 miles apart along I-90, and there are barely any settlements in between. And Jordan says that the federal plan would force Wyoming to not only put an EV charger in the middle of nowhere, as she says, but to build an interchange to get off the highway and to the charger. And meanwhile, the state of Wyoming says the federal rules means it couldn't build fast chargers on the way to the state's biggest tourist draws.
Economically, with our rural nature and limited EV adoption so far, it didn't make sense to put stations where they likely wouldn't see very many visits compared to stations on the way to Yellowstone National Park, which is off corridor for us, off the interstate. But that's where a lot of our traffic is headed.
Jordan says that while EV owners may like the idea of charging up for 15 minutes and then driving off, Wyoming's smaller towns would prefer folks to actually stay a while.
A lot of the communities that have expressed interest in these chargers so far are wanting the lower level chargers to encourage tourists or visitors or, you know, people passing through to stop and eat and shop and spend time in their town instead of charging fast and leaving. So there seems to be more interest in the lower level chargers, even though they're not necessarily what the plan was originally designed to put in.
That's Jordan Ox from the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Now, Samantha and Alexandra, I know that you've been looking at the state plans, including Wyoming's. First of all, Alexandra, let me start with you. It seems to me that Wyoming is a perfect example of how the states have different needs. And what's your response to Wyoming saying, well, we're going to leave the money on the table if we can't actually put the chargers in the way we want to?
Well, look, you know, Jordan makes some very important points here. And we know from looking at the plans and from hearing from, you know, some state DOTs across the country that a lot of these rural states are, concerned about some of the guidance in terms of, you know, where these chargers need to be located in terms of, you know, these DC fast charging stations every 50 miles along these highway corridors. And they're asking for some flexibility to put them where they make sense for, you know, their state's needs, for the needs of the people who live there and the people who come and visit. So, you know, we are expecting that the joint office will make some, you know, will take those into consideration and make some decisions. But it certainly seems to me that, you know, as we think about what different states' needs are and sort of the charging experience that people want to have when they're there, you know, that flexibility could be a good thing and can make the program stronger and ultimately, you know, lead to a better, more convenient charging network as a result. Mm.
Samantha, I can't help but to say that I think maybe my journalistic cynicism is wondering if we're a few years from now, we might see some Oppo ads on TV of a DC charging station in the middle of nowhere gathering dust with tumbleweeds blowing by it, whereas there's, you know, a line for the chargers within a 10-mile radius of Yellowstone National Park. I mean, shouldn't there have been more flexibility from in the Biden proposal from the start?
Sure. And you're hitting on sort of the inherent challenge of having guidelines that fit, you know, 50 states plus D.C. plus Puerto Rico to a T, right? So I think, you know, one way the administration has built in some flexibility is this process where they can appeal for exemptions from certain requirements. So, you know, I don't want to prejudge what the Highway Administration will decide on those requests, including Wyoming's request. But I do think that having that there is a sign that they do want to listen to states. And notably, community engagement is a really key piece of the guidance. And so the fact that Wyoming does have feedback from communities on some of these issues, I think, is pretty compelling. And I would also say, certainly some charging stations will be very highly utilized and some will be less utilized. And certainly we don't want a station that doesn't get used at all. We don't want any tumbleweeds rolling by, but there will be some stations that are less used but are essential to having minimum coverage to give drivers that confidence. So I think we do need to be intentional and careful about making sure that these stations have their best chance to be as utilized as possible. But at the same time, the fact that more rural stations that are essential for coverage but maybe less utilized, that really speaks to why we have to have these federal investments in charging, including having operations and maintenance for the first 5 years as an eligible expense to support these stations, make sure they're in good working order, and like I said, give drivers confidence that they can take their road trip. They can drive their further distances.
But really, every 50 miles? I mean, we have cars, EVs that can travel quite a long way on one charge now. Every 50 miles seems really close together.
You're right, absolutely, that the current generation of battery electric vehicles have over 200 miles, some way more, you know, 300 plus miles of expected range. And so, you know, those vehicles may not need to stop as often. But I would also say, you know, I think to Alec's point, Alec from the clips we heard earlier, it's thinking about your electric vehicle is charging is not so much like gas fueling. Mm-hmm. And even on road trips, I have found that I actually need to stop a little more frequently than I need to fill up gas. So if you're making slightly more frequent stops, you could make shorter stops at a charger before your tank is fully depleted and sort of have a more optimal experience that way. So that's just sort of one reason why stations that, you know, are 50 or maybe we'll see what the joint office says. You know, it could be that they relax that a little bit. But we do need some minimum spacing to accommodate more frequent stops potentially, as well as, you know, not everyone is going to get to a point where they want to charge at the same time. And so
I'm only smiling because I get, you're not the kind of driver that likes to drive on fumes or the last little bit of energy.
No,
from the electronics.
I'm a more cautious driver, but I do have friends who they say it's like playing tank roulette. They try to roll as far as they can.
I get your point taken, but I do question that 50-mile requirement between charging stations because, again, it gets to sort of the question of are we building for today? Or are we building for a future, more electrified fleet across this country? And it doesn't seem to me that battery charging technology is going to go backwards. So, but I wanted to actually give our listeners a little bit more chance to have their say here, because I did ask that the question of them and of us here today, what's the best way to spend the $7.5 billion? So here's Bridget Bodie in Oklahoma City. And Bridget says it's not those long road trips that are stopping her from getting an electric vehicle, but rather a challenge that Bridget has day to day.
One of the limiting factors I found when considering an electric vehicle is renting an apartment. There's no way to modify your parking space overnight or your work. So the main places I am are not equipped with the power to charge a vehicle. So I would have to rely on charging stations where there's no. You just have to sit there and wait for your car to charge.
Okay, so Bridget wants it for easier for easy. Excuse me, Bridget wants it to be easier for urban apartment dwellers to charge their EVs. Now, this is Shane Dury from Lynchburg, Virginia. Shane works in the solar industry, and when he looks at the roofs or those canopies over gas stations, he sees an opportunity.
When we start converting to electric vehicle charging stations, it makes perfect sense to have the canopies exactly like they look now, but have solar panels on top of them so that the charging of the EVs is done through clean, renewable solar energy. I'm sure it's way more complex than it seems to me at the moment, but it absolutely seems like a tremendous idea and something that we should shoot for so that as we are charging more or less clean energy vehicles, we are using clean, renewable energy to charge them.
So Shane's seeing an opportunity in infrastructure that already exists. And here's one more. This is a listener called McCullough from Ventura, California, who says that to her, her frustration isn't so much what the plan is. It's the fact that the federal government would even consider paying for EV chargers.
I don't get that. You know, Henry Ford, when he started making cars and pumping them off of the production line, the government did not build gas stations. Private industry should be doing this. Elon Musk has all this money to go to the moon. He can build his own damn charging stations as far as I'm concerned. I don't know why taxpayer money should be doing this. There's better uses for it.
Okay. So, Alexander, on that point, I mean, there are... We already talked about Volkswagen and Tesla also already having their own and building private networks of charging stations. What do you make of McCullough's point there that maybe the government shouldn't be spending a dollar on it?
Well, you know, there's no question that there's been a lot of and will continue to be a lot of private sector build out of EV charging, utility build out of EV charging. But the question that I ask is, where's that build out happening? Who has easy access to that infrastructure and who's being left out? To Don's point from earlier, you know, not every community has access to this, and particularly communities of color and particularly low-income communities have borne the brunt of our transportation network as it exists today in terms of air pollution and other negative consequences. So we think that there is an opportunity to use public funding, including federal funding, to make sure that those communities are seeing the benefits of this transition to electric vehicles. In fact, the Biden-Harris administration has made it clear that equity should be front and center, not only with EV charging, but with all of our climate investments under the Justice 40 initiative. And I want to mention just one state, and that's Massachusetts. As I was looking through the plan that they put together for the NEVI program, they really thought about, you know, which of our highway corridors already have EV charging and which don't. And on top of that, which highway corridors are near environmental justice and disadvantaged communities and which aren't. And they're really thinking about how can we use this funding to fill in the gaps and make sure that environmental justice communities are seeing this infrastructure as well. We think there's a really good role for federal funding to play there where, you know, maybe some of that infrastructure won't be profitable right away because we're still waiting for more and more people to be able to afford EVs and buy EVs. But that federal funding can play a big role in making sure that that charging infrastructure is accessible to everybody.
Mm. And so then I keep thinking about Wyoming because the Wyoming version of that would possibly be what we heard earlier, that there are some maybe economically depressed towns. Again, if we're talking about justice, there's economic justice that could better use the EV charging stations than putting one between Cheyenne and Laramie, as we heard earlier. But Samantha, in the last minute that we have here, you have the last word today. How important is it, no matter how it's done, for the nation to have some kind of reliable nationwide EV charging network?
It's essential. It's absolutely essential. And I would also lift up what Alex said about how all of the federal investments, including the National EV Charging Program, need to comply with the Justice 40 targets. We don't want anyone left behind in this transition to an electrified transportation future.
Well, Samantha Houston, Senior Vehicles Analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Transportation Program, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
And Alexander Laska, Senior Policy Advisor for Transportation at the think tank Third Way. Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Meghna. Appreciate it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.